Right. Welcome to this seminar at the Education Employers Task Force, part of our London seminar series, co-sponsored by the Education Industry at the University of Warwick. The point of these seminars is trying to sort of close the gap between people who work in universities doing really interesting thinking around what happens when somebody from the economic community gets involved in the educational experiences of young people, and trying to make it as accessible as possible for policymakers, practitioners, other researchers to understand the insights and findings which they've had. Now, today we have two researchers from Birmingham City University, Professor Richard Hatcher and Dr. Tricia Le Gallais, who are doing some really fascinating work which covers all these bases between research, to policy and practice. Their work has generated a lot of interest. We're really delighted that they're here today to be able to talk to us. So I'll introduce you to you. Tricia, you're going to kick off?
Yeah.
Tricia Le Gallais.
Thank you. Thank you very much for staying on to listen to the work that we're going to share with you. I'm going to be talking about the findings from two pieces of research, one which I undertook with my colleague Richard, and the other one which was more recent, and I carried that out by myself. So if I just go through the first piece that I want to share with you is actually attempting in a few minutes to give you a synopsis of this report entitled Work Experience Placements of Secondary School Students, Widening Horizons or Reproducing Social Inequality. So our original research was undertaken in 2006-07 and this report was published in 2008. We investigated the distribution of students to placements with a particular emphasis on differentiation by social class. We also looked at the allocatory processes adopted by the schools with regards to placing their students into work experience placements. The other areas which I will touch upon are sharing with you the pupils' experiences on placement and also the comments they make about the impact and the influence that their work experience placement has actually had upon them in terms of interpersonal skills, increased confidence, and actually rethinking their future plans. The schools involved in the research, there were five schools, and as you can see, it was reasonably large scale. 1,000 students were involved in questionnaires, followed by 100 interviews with students, and then we also met with staff who were responsible for the programme. One of these schools, Avon School, anonymised obviously as Avon, was a school which had its intake selected by ability. The other four schools were comprehensives. We used eligibility for free school meals as an indicator of the school's socioeconomic status, which actually, although is a bit limited as an indicator, it did allow us to categorise the schools as high SES, Avon, with about 2% of its students on free school meals. Middle SES, Bedford and Cumbria, which were about 10 to 12% of students on free school meals. And then low SES, Devon and Essex. And Essex was about 66% free school meals. And as of 2011, the head reckoned it was nearer to 72% of students on free school meals. The key findings, there were many. I've identified a couple to share with you, and then Richard will be drawing all the threads together when I've completed this first part. What we found, without doubt, was that work placements do powerfully reflect and reproduce patterns of social class inequality, and very few actually widen students' horizons in terms of vocational aspirations. And I've just given you there a couple of quotes. Can you actually see those at the back? Are they clear to read? One low SES, one high SES. Low SES, they expected me to clean the toilets. I walked out because it was the third time I'd done it that week. The second one, talking of going into court, meeting with barristers, going to chambers, attending trials, and sitting with the judge. And I think you can compare and contrast quite easily there what potential those two placements had for raising these young people's aspirations. The other key thing for me, because I continued this research with Essex School, was that four of the five schools were very much hands-off in their approach to pupils' choice of placements, i.e., as this teacher at Avon High SES School says, let's be honest, I've got 156 students for 156 placements. I haven't got time. You know, let them go. As far as I'm concerned, just they sort it out. If it's not that good a placement, well, they'll learn from that. But of course, what isn't added is the difference between the contacts, the social network that the parents at Avon had in comparison with the low SES schools. Essex was found to have quite a distinctive approach. Its pupils had far more support and direction and far less choice. One of the questions we asked the students was, who found your placement? And you can see the contrast there. High SES were saying, oh, we found our own placement. When you probed further, you had comments like, well, my father owns the firm, so. Low SES, of the students who did try to find their own, it tended to be, well, I walked along the high street, went into all the shops until one said they'd take me. A couple of examples of students' comments here from high, middle and low SES. Here again, you can see the impact of parental capital in terms of the social networks that they are able to call upon, whereas the young pupil from the low SES school knew people who worked there. Just giving you a quick overview of the parental occupations in our first set of research. Managerial professional occupations, 63% at Avon, compared with 0.4% at the low SES. And if you look at these two figures here, Essex, 38% of parents were unemployed, compared with 8% at Avon. Of those 8%, when we interviewed the students, it was mainly mothers who were staying at home until their children were old enough to go to school, and then they would be moving back into work. I thought it would be interesting for you to also have a feel for what some of the staff were saying, because obviously staff's perceptions of parental expectations and pupil aspirations plays an important part in this. I think just two or three things. A lot of their parents don't have jobs, so the pupils' aspirations are low. They're aspiring only to do what brother or sister are doing, which tends to be working in a shop. I found this very telling. Maybe they don't perceive their life travelling far. And then you contrast this. And now this is a turnaround of the ceiling. It isn't looking up, not being able to reach. It's standing on the ceiling saying, my child will not work beneath that ceiling. Just to give you again an example of what types of things the students were doing on placement, and you've got the contrast there between Avon High SES, Devon Low SES. Were they carrying out menial tasks? Were they work shadowing? Were they actually encouraged to take responsibility and carry out quite responsible tasks? Again, 19% of Avon students were talking about putting up medicines, which is a bit worrying, 3% only from Devon. And then this treated as a colleague. What these statistics do for me is to actually reinforce how if you were in a placement and you were treated with respect, given responsibility and encouraged as a colleague, you would actually feel that you could work there, you could be part of that, you could belong there. If you're not, then that place is not going to be somewhere you would aspire to. And I've given you here a couple of examples from pupils' experiences from high and low SES. What comes over with this one is being encouraged to take responsibility, obviously having some training, and you compare it with this one, yeah. We weren't allowed to go on the tills because that required training. So this person wasn't valued, was just placed, whereas this one actually felt they were really getting to grips with the job, which was a responsible job. Not only is it what they do, but it's how they're treated by the staff they work with. And these two examples show you the relationship that these young people had with placement staff. Now, it may be that this young girl needs to grow up, but being told you need to grow up and only speaking to them when you tell them what to do, which is how she felt, is not going to move her forward. In contrast, you have this high SES student who's actually being mentored, and they're being told about the different types of roles and specialisations that they could go into. So they're seeing that as quite a potentially exciting job that they could choose, in contrast to the others. I feel I need to adjust the balance slightly, because there were low SES school students who did have very worthwhile experiences. And so what I've tried to show you here are some of the benefits that students shared with us. So building on their communication skills, being a lot more confident, learning to be patient, and of course here, actually learning an awful lot about working in the legal profession. And that's actually finished with me, so it's now over to Richard. This is my second part, which I will come on to, but Richard's going to summarise for us the key findings from the research I've just talked through.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Well, in 5 minutes, what I want to try and do is just offer you a sort of overview of how we're thinking about the findings of this research. The findings can be summed up in one sentence, really, which is middle-class kids get middle-class professional placements and working-class kids get working-class placements. Of course, that's a general statement. There are exceptions, but the pattern is very clear, and it's the result of a number of social processes that work together very powerfully to reproduce patterns of social class inequality. Those patterns themselves are differentiated by gender and ethnicity, and that's important, but we haven't got time to deal with that here. So what I want to do is to consider how this field of local available employment becomes a socially differentiated field. And that means conceptualising the processes at work not simply as a list of factors, but as a complex web of relationships. And I'm making use here of Bourdieu's notion of social field as a structured system of social positions and social relationships. Its boundaries, in terms of spatial boundaries, are set by the workplaces of the local economy, although of course some of those workplaces are not accessible to students, for example for legal reasons they're not allowed to take them on. Access to what remains, the field of locally available workplaces, is shaped in socially differentiating ways by a number of processes, and one of them is simply social selection by employers. In fact, in James Dawkins' research, he gives a very good example of private schools, employers actually approaching private schools looking for people who want to come on work placements. That's very different from the experience of most state schools, although it can be the case with selective schools as well. But much more important than that is a combination of student choice and the strategies that schools adopt. And the predominant strategy that schools adopt, as Tricia said, is to prioritise student choice, either because a combination really of two reasons. Administratively it's much simpler, plus the argument that, well, if they choose their own, they're more likely to actually turn up and enjoy it and so forth. But the sort of forms of guidance that schools give to students may themselves, do I need to move on to, yeah, may themselves actually reinforce patterns of social selection by, for example, simply the suggestions they make as to where you might try, or the way in which databases are structured and the composition of them. Some schools do intervene more directly in finding placements for students, and often that's tied to vocational courses. And while that clearly has some benefits, it also closes off other options and locks kids into particular sorts of work placements. But if we look at social students' social choices that they make, how are they shaped? Well, first of all, by what we might call students' horizons for action. And horizons for action is a concept that combines both perceptions of the, both the objective possibilities out there in the neighbourhood, in the area, and students' perceptions of them. And in that context, the decisions that students make are governed by a number of factors, which can be divided into career-related factors and non-career-related factors. By non-career-related factors, I mean things like, for example, that workplace is close and easy to get to, or I'm going to go back to my primary school to do my work placement because it's a familiar site, or I'm interested in music, and therefore I'm going to find a place in a record store, though that's not part of where I see my career going. But the career-related choices, which are based on either, in some cases, students' clear conception of where their futures lie, or just a feeling of, I'm going to try this and see if I like it. And all of that takes place in a concept, and I pinch the word from Stephen Ball and Meg Maguire, of socioscapes. In other words, the local landscape in relation to work that as it's perceived by young people. What does the world of work in their area look like to young people? Which bits of it are salient and obvious and familiar? The shops, the record stores and so on, the local garage, whatever. And which bits are hidden away and therefore not part of how they of the possibilities that they perceive? And that is connected to students' emerging vocational identities. And by that, I don't just mean the sort of futures they positively envisage for themselves as possible. I also mean those futures that they don't consider as possible, that may not even be registering on their radar as possibilities for them. It's a sort of taken for granted thing. We said that teachers play an important role, positive or negative, in shaping student choice of work placements. But of course, the other major factor in our research was the role of parents and the aspirations that parents have. Now, there's a debate about the extent to which parents' aspirations are class differentiated or not. But what is crucial is whatever parents' aspirations for their young their daughters and sons are, the crucial thing is their capacity to actually practically help them to move in those directions. And that very clearly is socially differentiated in terms of the social and cultural capital that parents bring to bear. By cultural capital, I mean the knowledge of the whole business of work placements, of how it relates to the rest of schooling, about how particular placements may relate to future destinations and so forth. And by social capital, I mean the social relationships that parents have that they may be able to exploit in order, just as we saw with the students who had a relative who was a barrister, that sort of connection that opens up different sorts of possibilities for children from young people from middle-class backgrounds and from working-class backgrounds. Just one final point, which is that how much of all this does it matter In other words, what is the relationship between work placements and final work destinations? And actually, we don't know. I mean, there is an assumption that there is some sort of connection. It is an area that needs further research. To what extent do those placements actually shape future destinations? Okay, thanks. And we're over to Tricia again now. Another seamless handover, I hope.
Well, without James, it wouldn't be. But
yeah.
Thank you. Having carried out the work in 2008, there was one school, Essex School, which I mentioned before, which stood out. And I felt by saying that schools hadn't done justice to a lot of their students in the way the work experience programme ran, that I ought to actually go back and look at Essex School again, because there were two things that were happening with Essex School. To start off with, they had quite a large number of what we've called professional placements, which was much higher than we would have expected, bearing in mind their low socioeconomic status, the location, the lack of jobs amongst their parents, etc. But it was also the most directive. And so those two things made me want to find out a little bit more about Essex School. Now, in order to set the context for the head teacher, because I'm going to give you a couple of her comments in a moment, I just wanted to say that this research was carried out at the time when work experience was a statutory requirement, or work-based learning. I know with Wolf we're looking at different issues now, but at this present time, schools were expected to provide placements, and usually this was in key stage four. And I've just given you there an example of a comment from the DfE regarding advice to schools, where they say, well, we do understand that if the young person is uncomfortable, that may be counterproductive and they may leave the placement, but at the same time, we do ask schools to reflect on whether they should give complete choice of placements for obvious reasons. So I actually put this to the head at Essex School, and her reaction was no uncertain terms, no way. I don't want them to be comfortable. I want them out of their comfort zone. Otherwise, this area is it for them. I've got to do more than that for these young people. So in discussion, it's sorry, my notes are being removed.
No,
here.
Sorry about that.
Well, you know, you can't get the staff. In discussion again with the head about this very interventionist stance, she then went on to explain that in loco parentis for that school was what they lived to the full. Because she actually quotes, we have to be the parent. Our pupils' parents are not able or cognizant enough to play the game. And I thought that was just a brilliant quote. And she actually says, we have to direct them to give them the opportunity of seeing a different side of life. So, in order to show you what this is it really is, I've just given you a quick summary of the school in context. Inner city suburb, one of the most socially and economically disadvantaged areas in the country, high unemployment. The school has a very high percentage of students on free school meals, 86% have English as a second language, and I've given you there the predominant ethnic makeup of the school. One of the comments that a member of staff made to me was that they've just built up their sixth form, and she said, what we're worried about is we don't have sufficient space for it, and we've been offered an area about 200 metres down the road, but that would mean they'd have to walk past the drug gangs, and we can't allow that. We have to look after them. That really shook me to think that stepping outside the school gates could be that dangerous. I conducted this research in 2010-11, and it was very small. I worked with 36 year 12 students and the staff involved in work experience, plus additional data from the school and meeting with the head. Now, what was really important when I taught with them, it was not the get a placement at all costs, push them out for 2 weeks. I actually heard someone say when I was wandering up to get a drink that some schools view it that way, get them out for 2 weeks, let's have a break. This school certainly doesn't look at it that way. Their placements have to be quality, which enables students to look beyond the narrow horizons of their neighbourhood. And also, not only are the Essex WEP staff interventionists with their students, they also are very directive with their employers. As you can see here, Sian, the member of staff I spoke to, when I talk with employers, I am clear about what I want. If they're going here, they're going to be doing work which fits that placement. They're not just going to be making the tea. They're going to get very involved. And in one case, one young lad actually was given a research project looking at antiemetic medication, which the staff then used. So, I mean, what a lift that must have been for him. So is their approach working? Well, I think the figures speak for themselves. You can see the number of professional placements they achieved. Bear in mind that over 28% of the parents of these pupils are likely to be out of work, and yet they're getting nearly that number of professional placements. They really do work hard to achieve opportunities for their young people to see jobs which they may not have had access to in any other way. I asked the students four questions. The one was checking on whether the school was still as directive as it was in 2006-07, and yes, it is. It's interesting because Sian says, oh, it's very much the pupil's choice. But when you talk to the pupils, they say, no, the school found it. And trying to work out what it was, it clearly is that Sian actually ensures that is a really good bank of very strong, valuable and worthwhile placements, and the students choose from those. So I believe it's still very directive. Okay, what did they do? Not many menial things. Only 9% mentioned menial or basic tasks. The majority felt that they were actively engaged as a real member of staff, doing things which enabled them to appreciate what that job would be about. And one of the students actually gave me some thoughts here on what she was doing, and she talks about far greater expectations, higher aspirations, really excited about actually going into the health, something in the health profession. So you can see what that's done for this young woman. Benefits, all sorts of things coming out, but most strongly communication skills, interpersonal skills, the confidence of working with adults and people they don't know, which was very important for these young people, giving them increased sense of responsibility, knowing more about the world of work, and what was an important factor for me was widening their ideas about the types of jobs they might apply for. And had their work experience influenced them in any way? You can see very strongly encouraging them to work harder at school. I'm sure the staff will be thrilled to hear that. As I've mentioned, far more ideas about future careers. Certainly a lot more now considering university, seeing it as something which they could aspire to. And most importantly for me, in terms of the social justice aspect here, that they actually were beginning to think that they had a right to look at jobs they didn't think were for the likes of them. And I think it's best shown by pupils' comments. There was quite a contrast between the type of placement and the employment background of their family. So I've just given you here three examples of pupils' comments. So Children's Hospital Pharmacy, and I really like that one, being encouraged to not only go into meetings, but to actually give their opinions as well. So a summary of the findings from this small-scale research: the number of professional placements has increased considerably. Many students say they're now intending to go to university, and a large number are really thinking now about having options beyond what they thought they could aspire to. So my observations, the directive stance really works for this school. The directive stance with regards to employers as well really works, because the placements the students are having are challenging and worthwhile. And what's really important is that the programme at Essex forms just one part, even if it is a very significant one, of the school's overall strategy of enhancing their pupils' psychological capital and actually responding to the dearth of social capital. So they really are widening young people's horizons. And that's in fact what Richard's now going to talk to you about.
Okay. Somehow my notes mysteriously disappeared. That's why I was looking through your stuff. But I'll have to look at this. Well, let me move out of the way so that I can...
They're on the path.
Oh, were they? Right, okay. Clearly a case of commercial piracy at work. In this... last few minutes, I want to try and answer the question, what would a work experience policy designed to challenge students' existing social class shaped conceptions, aspirations, emerging vocational identities look like? How could it widen horizons rather than reproduce them? And the first thing is, don't put it off till after 16. And I think government is making a big mistake and you know the consultation period is going on at the moment until the end of January. The CBI and a number of other organisations have already made submissions saying that it should be retained and indeed improved before 16 as well as after. Secondly, of course it's got to be high quality. The CBI report Action for Jobs, which came out in October, identifies, you know, quite a number of work experience placements, which were little more than photocopy management. So clearly we want an experience that's valuable in terms of the content of it. They recommend that an award be given to schools that meet their criteria. Employability schools, a new standard that would try and ensure that there's high quality. Third thing is, of course, that students need experiences of a range of different types of workplaces. In particular, that students from poorer backgrounds need access to high status, professional, high-level technical workplaces for work placements. But it cuts the other way as well. Students who might have their eye on those barristers' chambers also need experiences of other types of workplaces. But of course, simply offering different types of workplaces doesn't necessarily tackle the question of class inequality. We need to do more than that. And the first thing is to start in the primary school. By year 10 or year 11, young people's vocational identities are beginning to crystallise out. It's much too late because they're initial aspirations and conceptions of who they are and where their futures might lie start to be formed early on in the primary school. Not just in terms of, as I said, what possible futures they may see for themselves, but what other futures they don't see for themselves that are not part of the images that they have. And that entails, then, not just talking about 2 weeks of work experience in year 10 or year 11, but the notion that work experience needs to be a dimension of the curriculum throughout primary and secondary schooling. And that means a range of different forms of engagement between school and the world of work. Study visits, topics in the curriculum, dimensions built into topics, people coming into school and so forth. All of that, widening horizons, opening up opportunities. So if you're going to do a topic in year four on dinosaurs, well, good, but who digs them out of the ground? Who does the forensic work on them? If you're going to do a topic on the Anglo-Saxons and their beautiful jewellery, good, get a jeweller in or take the kids to a jeweller's workshop. So there are all sorts of ways in which that range of work experiences can be built into the curriculum. And now I want to say something controversial, which is this. It's not the job of schools simply to prepare young people for the world of work in a narrow sense of developing employability skills. We have to think beyond that and beyond simply widening people's awareness and ask the difficult questions about the nature of the work process and the nature of things that are produced, the quality of working conditions, systems of power and control in the workplace, and so forth. That's part of children's education. We can trace that tradition back to John Dewey and his work on vocational education. It relates to themes in the citizenship curriculum, for example. It also relates to the new RSA program around the notion of an area-based curriculum and using the resources of the neighbourhood, the locality, in the curriculum. And of course, one of those key resources are workplaces. So my final point, if we're talking about giving awards to schools as employability schools that offer high quality work experience, we also need to be talking about recognising workplaces that open themselves up to educational inquiry, of which work placements would be a part. And if we want to give them an award for being a school-friendly workplace, good, that's fine. And maybe annual award-giving ceremony will encourage employers to open up their workplaces in that way. On two bases. First, that they are committed to widening horizons, particularly for young people from poorer backgrounds. And secondly, they're open not just to a narrow conception of developing employability skills, but a wider conception of developing in young people a critical understanding of the world of work. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Sir Richard and Tricia. I think you weren't here this morning where we're talking about some of the outcomes of these sorts of activities, but I think there's a lot of alignment between what I was saying this morning and what Richard and Tricia have been saying here. If you go on our website, you'll see last month we had a seminar from Louise Archer, Professor of Sociology at King's College, who was talking very much about the importance of primary, the primary 8 years, as well as lots of career identities are being formed. I'd just like to say thank you to Richard and Tricia. So thank you very much. Okay, at this point we turn the camera off. And we have about 10, 15 minutes for comments, observations, questions, challenges. The floor is yours. I'll point to people and if you could say kind of who you are and where you're from, then that might be helpful. And then Richard, Tricia, you're good to say a bit more. Yep. We should say we'll put the slides on our website and we'll put the video on our website as well. And there's that 2008 report is on our website already.